the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fuckaholics, what the fucking avians, and what the fuckadelics? That's enough. I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to my show. Where are we at? What day is it? It's Thursday. What is it? The 5th? March 5th? Hey, look, let's stick with some practical stuff. I can tell you this. A second show has been added in Seattle. For the Marination Tour, I know a second show has been added in Toronto. I know a second show has been added in Boston as well. Friday, May 8th, there's a late show at the Neptune in Seattle now, okay? And at the Bloom Appel in Toronto on April 19th, there is now a second show added there. And at the Wilbur on April 11th. So I just wanted to let those people know, because clearly in those areas, tickets are selling good. But I'm excited. I think I'll be funny. I'm staying in shape. You know, I'm going out on weekends. I'm doing the stand-up. But boy, I am fried today, man. I am fried. I did pieces of three different episodes today. A friend of mine told me that's how they shoot porn. And she's actually in the porn industry, so I think I have a right to tell you that my pussy is a little exhausted. Yeah, it was a long day, you guys. But I was thinking about what I was talking about on Monday, because I think I'm understanding something. Like I talked about not really giving a fuck anymore, and I don't know that that's necessarily the way to phrase it. Because I started to realize something, that there is an outside chance that I may be just growing the fuck up. I know it's surprising, but I might just be growing the fuck up. Maybe things aren't going to work out exactly how I want them to. Maybe things don't always feel as good as you want them to. And sometimes even when you reward yourself or expect a reward, that may not come. All those things. And I know I've paid lip service to this before. You know, that like, you know, if you're looking for the world or everybody in your life to parent you, or even your job to take care of you in a way that you wanted your parents to, it's just not going to happen. And I think what's finally happening naturally is I truly realize this. There's a sort of deadening inside. There's a part of your heart that just withers because it realizes that it is not going to get what it wants, but that's okay. You should have closure on that thing a long time ago. So eventually it just has to wither. You have to kind of beat it up a bit. There's just a little part of your heart that's sort of like, come on, I just give me everything I want. And if I can't have it, I'm going to be angry. And that part eventually goes, I'm not angry anymore because it's just not going to work out the way I want it to. And then eventually it's like, it doesn't matter. I'm okay. Doesn't matter. I'm okay. No, I understand. I'm okay. That is being a grown-up. I understand. I'm okay. Yeah, it's a little disappointing. I'm okay. Yeah, no, I'll be okay. That's horrible, but I'm okay. I can handle it. Just that instinct, that little switch. Oh my God, this is whatever it is, but I'm okay. As opposed to, oh my God, this is shitty, and I'm going to make it shittier by reacting in this tone. I feel like I've graduated to adulthood, and it only took me 51 years and two marriages and no children on earth to get there. And it's a little painful. It's a little cruel, to be honest with you. Did I mention that Rob McElhaney is on the show today, the creator of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which is currently in its 10th season. It's on FXX Wednesday nights, and the season finale is on March 18th. It's been a while since we tried to talk a while back and finally got it to happen, so that's exciting. I just feel so grown up. Can you feel the grown-upness? I guess what I've been talking about is the heartbreak of being a grown-up. That I think I knew it intellectually, but But I think the biggest lesson you can learn after a certain point is you're going to have to suck it up a little bit. I'm not talking a tough love thing. I just mean if you don't want to walk around feeling depressed and injured and wounded and like an open wound for your entire life, which I believe is possible, you're going to have to just deaden that part of your heart that's infantile. Just anesthetize it with the rationalization or something. Quiet that fucker down. All right. I do hope you're having a good day. And let's talk to Rob McElhaney. Does anyone ever track you down? And that's the guy.
No, but very recently I had an incident right outside of our house.
Yeah.
There was like five or six cars parked out there with young dudes with cameras.
Right.
And so, and they're all just kind of staking out.
Yeah.
And I got my kids out there. And so I put my kids inside and I walk out and I say, hey, can I help you?
Yeah.
And the guy goes, yeah, you live next to some famous people. And I was like, oh man, all right.
So they were just general paparazzi?
Yeah, not there for me, not there for us, but we have a couple of famous neighbors.
Oh, really?
And so they were there to shoot them.
So you were ready for battle?
I flew right under their radar, which we're happy about.
And even when you're right to their face, nothing?
Nothing.
Isn't that great?
It's great.
That you have that type of fame where it's just the people that know you, and everybody else, fuck them.
It's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
It's kind of perfect.
So now, all right, well, you want to talk about this possible move and this concern?
Well, yes, I'm. We're building a house in Brentwood,
California.
You
want to talk about how big?
I'd rather not.
A good size house.
Yeah, it's a good size house. I mean, it's like, you know, when you're building your own house, you get to choose. You know, you get to build everything you would ever want in a house. So,
well, are you like? But are you crazy or are you reasonable?
A little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
Is it going to be a baseball field?
No baseball field. There will be a gym with mats,
right?
For grappling,
sure,
things like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Wrestling, hands on stuff,
jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, why not?
Why not?
You're gonna start teaching classes?
Yeah, because we haven't. No. I'm about 15 years off from that.
Okay,
but maybe I'll bring teachers in, and we'll invite kids from the neighborhood.
That'd be good.
Yeah. But you know, I always wanted a movie theater in my house.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to build that. That's probably our biggest excess.
You can do that now. Who does? I just, I mean, like you do that with, you can do it right through your computer, really. Yeah. I mean, you don't need to, are you going to put a film theater in?
Not a film, but you know, with a projector.
Right.
You know,
projector. Yeah. Who was that? I was at Louis' house and he's got like a setup where it's like hanging from the ceiling.
Yeah.
And you can do it right off the Apple TV or whatever through the computer.
Yeah, and the studios have this system too that you have to pay some exorbitant amount of money, but you can get onto this circuit where you can watch the first run movies the weekends that they come out.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You can do that through like a is it like all the studios movies through one area?
Yeah, you have to sign up with each individual studio pay them some obscene amount of money.
That's like a Secret Service.
Yeah.
Where'd you learn about that one?
I have connections.
Yeah, I guess.
I have connections. So that's what I'm looking forward to probably most. But yeah, it's a little scary for me to move into that environment.
Well, you have two kids.
Two kids, two boys.
And you grew up like in a scrappy neighborhood?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
Philly,
it was
like,
pretty scrappy.
Well, I mean, I've been to Philly a few times. You ever go to John's Roast Pork?
Sure. Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. Roast pork is the so cheesesteaks are what the city unfortunately is most famous
right,
for.
Right. I go the roast pork.
I go the roast pork too.
You do?
I mean, I can barely muscle down one of those cheesesteaks anymore. I think it's just my
Do you have an allegiance to one or the other? You don't give a shit.
No, I mean, the neighborhood that I grew up in was very close to Geno's and Pat's, which is like the big...
Right, those are the
famous,
two ones. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I was always partial to Jim's, which is on South Street.
Yeah.
Though I find it so sad that whenever I talk about Philadelphia, the first thing that comes up is my allegiance to some...
Sandwich?
Cheesesteaks, to a sandwich, as opposed to it being, you know, the birthplace of our nation.
What's the birthplace of a sandwich, too? I mean, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to figure out what's more important sometimes, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, one, I'm thank God for one, and now we have the other to talk about.
One allowed the other
exactly.
to exist.
Yeah. To sort of, it's weird because you go see the Liberty Bell. I mean, you do that. I go and I went and I'm like, yeah, here it is. I don't know if I, do you feel more
an
patriotic?
Allegiance?
Yeah.
No, not necessarily. I mean, as an adult now, when I go back, I do. But no, not necessarily. I don't think I feel any more or less patriotic than the average man.
I wish I knew more. Do you? I mean, could you like walk your kid around and kind of lay out the birth of our nation?
I could, but that's only because I got really into American history like long after I left school and just started reading up as much as I could on it. Yeah. And now every time I go back, I like to take those historical walks, much to the chagrin of my spouse.
She doesn't like it?
No. No.
She'd rather have a sandwich?
No, she's from Oregon. So, like, you know, she's like the to me, Oregon growing up didn't really exist.
No, that's where everyone ran away to avoid everything.
Yeah.
And
California, too. I mean, I never really thought of California as a real place.
Right.
You know?
Isn't there? Like, there's something about the East Coast where it's so densely populated and it feels like all the history is there and there's a type of person that's there that isn't anywhere else.
Mm-mm.
Like, there's something about, like, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, Long Island, Rhode Island. There's just a type of towny or sort of city mentality. It's nowhere else.
And I can't help it. I feel most home when I go back, even though
I
never
lock right in. It's like your accent probably changes.
Oh, without a doubt.
Like immediately?
Yeah, almost immediately. I mean, it depends on how much I'm drinking or how much I'm arguing.
But like Philadelphia is one of those places I didn't really know. I never was there when it was rough or bad, but it seems like it's one of those cities where they did a little bit of that renewal business in the downtown area, and it sort of worked. It's kind of fun to walk around and shit, and it's like, it's a great city.
It's a great city. I love going back. The neighborhood I grew up in is still a great neighborhood. It was just, I think in the 80s, it was kind of rough.
I mean, rough in what way?
You know, it was just lower middle class. I mean, great people, but
white,
I think
Irish, black,
a little bit of mixture of everything. There were still enclaves of
Italian, too,
right? Italian and Irish. Like even some of my like great aunts and grandmothers and things. They were prejudiced in a way, but not in the most obvious ways. Like they were nervous about Italians.
The Irish,
which you don't really see, you know, a lot now, because they were Irish,
right.
And you know, it was like the blacks they didn't really think about too much. It was the Italians they didn't trust,
right?
And because of it, I didn't really learn how to ride a bike till I was like 13 or 14.
Out of fear of Italians?
No, I don't know.
Yeah.
I was just told you are not riding your bike through, you know.
Yeah, not getting off a block.
Yeah, not getting off the. I think we were allowed to migrate maybe 3 blocks in any direction.
So, how big of a family did you come from, Irish?
My immediate family. My father came from 10, and my mother came from 9.
Oh my God!
Massive family.
And you're you got brothers and sisters?
Yeah. I have an older stepsister, a younger sister, and younger brother, and a youngest half brother.
So that's 4 or so.
That was or so. It depends. it depends on what year.
So you have
different
half,
years. I had different siblings.
Because you have a half brother on your dad's side, like your
my father's child from his second marriage.
How many times has he been married?
He's working on 3.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
This one's
happy.
Oh, yeah, this one.
This one's happy.
He leveled off?
I think so.
So who'd you grow up mainly with?
My dad.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, but we saw my mom on weekend. Every other weekend.
Usually it's the other way.
It was. My mom had to find herself.
Defined herself?
Had to find herself.
And how'd that pan out?
She, it panned out really well.
Yeah?
But it was rough there for a little while.
Not drugs?
No. She's gay.
Yeah.
But she didn't. I guess she always knew that. But
right.
It was really difficult in South Philadelphia
to be
gay. And I think on top of that, she wanted a family, and she wanted to. She went to Catholic school, and it was probably whipped into her that was
bad.
That was bad.
So she tried to stuff it down, get rid of it.
Yep.
Ah.
And so she did that by getting married, having 3 kids. And then actually was pregnant with a 4th, and they had a late-term miscarriage.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, she was, I think up until that point, in her mind, living the dream, living in Philly and raising kids, and then it just kind of came crashing down.
Just within her?
I think she was just unhappy. I think she realized that she was living something that was a lie. Even though she loved us and she loved our family, she certainly loved my dad, but it just wasn't working.
Wow. That's a big change.
Big change, yeah. Was I remember them sitting us down. I think I was 7 or 8, and it was not fully explained to us.
That she was gay?
No, right, exactly. Okay. It was just that mom needs to leave for a while. That was it. Yeah.
I've heard that once or twice before, the vague sort of like, she's got some things.
Yeah, well, we were 8. I think we were 8, 6, and 5 or something.
How do
like
you
that.
Even process wrap your brain around that?
We couldn't. I mean, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you just go, oh, I guess that's the way it's going to be. And of course it was, you know, you adapt. I mean, children, sure. You know, you adapt. But it was a bummer. I mean, I can look back on it now and I have such compassion and respect for her to make that decision in probably the most difficult time of her life. You know, but as a kid, I didn't get it at all.
But did she just move across town or?
Yeah. I mean, I remember there was a period in the beginning where we didn't see her for a little while.
Yeah.
And I think, and in my mind, I project that to be years, but I think it was only a few weeks mm-hmm. or maybe a few months. But, you know, relative to my life experience at that point, it was a really long time. And I think she was just sort of figuring out who she was.
Right.
And she found a partner very quickly. And they've been together now for over 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's like your second mom.
This is my second mother, yeah. I'm lousy with moms.
Really?
I got tons got of moms. I got so many mothers.
It's kind of a beautiful story.
Yeah, and my dad was really, he's just an amazing guy. He recognized, you know, when my mom came back and said, you know, let's figure this out. He said, I get it, let's figure it out. You know, she said, I want to have a relationship with my children. He said, you absolutely should. And they figured it out. They figured it out. And we're so close and continue to be so close that when my father went through, he got remarried after this, he went through a second divorce. There was some financial issues and he was going to lose the house. And he moved in with my mother and Mary for an extended period of time.
Really?
And they lived together in New Jersey. Yeah.
That's touching.
Yeah.
And they all still get along.
They do. Yeah.
New Jersey.
Yeah, South Jersey.
That's the other, that's right by Philly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
Jersey's the other place. That's where my family's from, Jersey. There's nothing like that area.
No, it's the best.
I know, it really is. Well, that's a great story, and everybody's good.
Everybody's pretty good.
And your brothers and sisters took to it and everything?
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't as difficult, looking back on it, even at the time.
Yeah.
I never felt like it was that difficult, and I think that was an extension of how my friends reacted to it.
But also your dad, too. I mean, like, it's...
Yeah.
I imagine those things can be difficult if your dad would have been like, fuck her, I can't, you know what I mean? But
yeah. No, that's not in my father's nature.
Yeah. But, like, I think that's what causes the weirdness, is if a parent freaks out. But how'd your friends react?
None of that happened. My friends were always super supportive. I mean, I remember really coming to terms with it when I was probably maybe in eighth grade, you know, or 13 or 14. Yeah. You know, I probably always knew but didn't want to admit it
to
myself.
That your mom was gay?
Yeah. And I remember, you know, maybe pulling aside one of my friends at one point and saying, hey, you know, I think my mom's gay. And he's like, yeah, no shit. And it turned out that all of my friends kind of already knew
because
she was living with a woman for as long as they had known her, almost for as long as I had known her.
Right.
And nobody cared.
Right.
Yeah, nobody on it. I don't ever remember having any altercation or issue with it amongst my peers. Ever.
Yeah. Well, it's weird. That Catholic thing really zaps your head. I don't know. And it also seems like when things go weird within a Catholic community, that eventually if they just stay kind of like, if people are committed to the whatever they might consider weird within Catholicism, eventually it just levels off. And they're like, well, that's just the way that is.
Yeah.
How Catholic were you brought up?
Super Catholic. I mean, I went to Catholic school all through my, through grade school, kindergarten, grade school.
Like you had to wear an outfit?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, wow. The whole deal, suit and tie.
And your dad was, you church
My dad's
goers?
Pretty, yeah, he still is. He still is. And my mother, it was really fascinating because we were with my mother on weekends and, you know, she lived across the street from a church. And so we had to go, you know, every Sunday. Meanwhile, we're like, what the fuck? No one, she's sending us across. And she's saying, you have to go, but she's not going, of course. And my dad.
Was she not going because she didn't believe, or she was ashamed, or what?
I don't know. I think it was probably a little bit of both.
Right.
I think it was a little bit of both.
Yeah.
But I actually really loved Catholic school.
Yeah.
I went to a single sex Catholic school.
All boys.
All boys.
Yeah.
All dudes.
So you liked it because it was it gave you a good competitive spirit, discipline?
Yeah, a little bit of that. Yeah, I think there was a tremendous amount of discipline, but also compassion. You know, this was the 90s. It wasn't the 50s. So I went to a Jesuit school, and their whole thing is just, you know, continually question authority, which is, you know, a really empowering thing to teach a 14-year-old boy, you know, and dangerous. From, I would think, from a scholastic perspective, you know, they're trying to corral these hormones filled.
That's the idea of the Jesuits?
It's a huge part of it. Yeah, they're constantly challenging you to question everything.
Well, that sort of defines the way you've approached your whole life in a way, huh?
My life?
Yeah, after a certain point.
Oh, yeah. Well, I credit my high school as having a major impact on my life and the way that I see the world.
Was there a teacher in particular?
There was a few.
Yeah?
There was a few. Yeah, I had this one, this nun.
Yeah.
Sister Kate Woody. And she, you know, she was tough. But I remember one time, you know, I had some discipline problems when I was a freshman.
How did those manifest?
I was super obnoxious, and I was really small.
Yeah.
I didn't hit puberty till like way late in life, like 16 or something like that. So I was a wrestler my freshman year, and I remember my exact weight because I was a wrestler. So the lowest weight class was 103.
Yeah.
But as a freshman, I wrestled the 103 in the 103-pound category, but I was 87 pounds. So 87 pounds as a 13-year-old boy is, you know.
Tiny. Yeah.
And all my friends were, you know, developing body hair and...
Late on everything.
Yeah.
It's like, worst. In the locker room, the worst.
Brutal.
What's going on, man?
Yeah. Yeah. So you learn, you know, you learn how to deal with various ways.
You learn to keep your towel on.
Yeah. One of them was just to get, like, as obnoxious as possible.
Right.
And belligerent and ready to fight and, you know, those kinds of things. And so it would manifest in that way. My grades were always really good, but I was always getting detention and, you know, suspended. And
so what would this sister teach, lay on you?
Well, one day I was in a big fight with one of the teachers, and he called me a pain in the ass, and I probably was, but then I kind of jumped, you know, I kind of continued that fight, and then a kid got involved, and then it got physical, and I got pulled away, and the disciplinarian came and pulled me into his office, and he gave me a lecture, and the another teacher came in, they gave me a lecture, and they're like, "You're fucked up. What are you doing? You know, what is this behavior? We're going to suspend you. We're going to expel you." And then Sister Kate comes in, and she's like, "McElhenney, come with me." So she pulls me into her office. I'm like, "Oh man, Sister Kate." She slams the door, and she goes, "You know, most people, just remember this. Most people in your life don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Get out." And that was it. And I left, and my head exploded.
What did that mean?
Because subsequently we had many conversations about it, but I think she was basically like laying a level of compassion on me that I couldn't quite comprehend, but it was like, look, you're going to be surrounded by people who are telling you what to do, how to do it, when to do it, all the time. But they don't really know. They're just as lost as you are.
Right.
And
right.
So some of your behavior, and again, I don't think she was excusing my behavior, but I think she was, you know, sometimes when you're a 14-year-old boy, you don't need to be told what to do all the time. You just want somebody to tell you that you're not bad.
Right.
And I think that's kind of what she was saying. And I took that and like, wow. So I had a teacher telling me that I was surrounded by people who oftentimes are just as lost as I am and don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
And that's true at every age.
Yeah. Yeah, and I took that and it could have been really destructive.
Right.
But they also had a community that sort of fostered discipline with that. So it wasn't just empowering insofar as, hey, do whatever you want. It was, okay, now take that attitude, but refine it with a certain level of scholastic enterprise or just discipline.
And empathy, too. I mean,
absolutely.
In order to not take that the way of like, well, fuck everything, you just got to sort of like, well, that just means we're all human.
Yeah.
And there's room for discussion and respect. And
Yeah. And so that kind of molded my entire experience through that high school. And then after that, I think there's still aspects of that conversation that I remember.
Yeah. Did you go to college?
No. No, in fact, it was a prep school, and I was the only person that didn't go to college. But that was never my intention. I just wanted to take a little time off after I graduated, and I did. And then I just started like visiting my friends at various schools to see which one I liked and was just going to apply, you know, a little bit later that year or next semester. And I noticed that all my friends were, they were just getting fucked up. So, which was great. It was a lot of fun, but they weren't. They were going, kind of going to class, but kind of not. They were racking up insane amounts of debt. And
so you're just hanging out at colleges.
Yeah. Oh, I did like the full college tour.
Because I know a guy knew you at Fordham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I lived at Fordham.
Right.
I lived in the dorms at Fordham.
You know, he said that, you know, you were sort of around this group of people that he hung out with, and they're all sort of rooting for you. You were just a guy that, you know, wasn't enrolled, but would kind of hang out and go to class sometimes and
stuff. Yeah, well, once I decided that I didn't want to go to college because I just felt like, in a lot of respects, I was too immature. Like, I wasn't really ready for it. I think there was, like, a certain level of social conditioning that's important in college, but also, you know, I just didn't have the yearning to sit in a classroom again for a while. But I thought eventually that would come back.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, let me just take a year off. And then in that year, I just saw, I don't know, it just seemed like a big waste of time to me. It didn't seem like anybody was taking it
seriously.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And it didn't seem like anybody was learning anything. They were just preparing their, in my mind, they were just preparing themselves for a lifetime of debt and maybe, I don't know, secondary schooling after that, or if they had, you know, very specific goals, which I didn't find that anybody did, whether it was like med school or law school or anything
like
that.
With your crew.
With my particular crew.
Right.
Yeah. And so I just thought, well, I don't know, maybe I won't go. So I moved to New York, and that's when I lived at Fordham in the dorm. I got an ID and everything.
You did?
Yeah.
I wound up talking,
I got a meal plan. I wound up talking to one of the guys there, and he hated the food, but his parents had bought him this meal plan. So
right.
I made this deal with him where I would give him whatever the meal plan was, a couple grand or something. I would just give him like $100 cash, which didn't cost him anything because his parents were paying for it. I would take all of his information. I would go to the to the registrar, and they would write me up like a new ID application. I would go to the ID, the security office. They would just, no questions asked, take the picture. So I had this ID that not only got me everywhere on campus, including the dorms and the security gates, but got me a meal plan. So I was, for all intents and purposes, a student at Fordham. And I would go to class sometimes. I would audit classes. I was a non-matriculating student, but I would go and I would sit in some of the classes that interested me.
Like what?
Well, that's when I kind of got into American history. So I started going to some of the history classes.
So you just like, you were going to college without paying?
Yeah.
And you got free food and free room and board?
Yeah.
But you were sweeping on people's floors, right?
I was, yeah. Actually, they lived in 8-man suites.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my buddies from high school, he had 7 men in one suite, and he had an extra bed in his room. So for 8 months, I mean, an entire school year, their entire sophomore school year, I lived at Fordham as a non-student resident.
And they didn't know.
I lived in the Bronx. No. You know how they found out? They found out because there was a play.
Yeah.
And I had the, looking back on it, it was a really dumb move, but I was making lots of dumb moves at that point because I had a good thing going. You know?
Yeah.
And it was Angels in America.
Right.
And I auditioned for the play.
Right.
Because everybody thought that I was a student. So I auditioned for the play. I get the part.
Right.
And
which part? Like the husband?
Yeah, the husband.
Yeah.
And Joe?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And so I get the part, and I'm super excited, and I get to the first day of rehearsals, and the director's like, he's a student, you know, he's fun, he's cool. But then there's like this older woman, and she's like clearly in like an administrative role or something like that. She comes, hey, can I talk to you for a second? I was like, oh, fuck. I knew right away. So it turned out that the kid who was also up for the role but didn't get the role, rightfully,
because
the truth is it was a student production. It should be all students. I think he ratted me out. And so they were like, who are you? What are you doing here? And I said, I'm a friend, and I was interested in the play. And luckily, they didn't. They started to sniff around, and by that point, the school year had ended, and I moved out.
Got out.
I got out.
Well, they really couldn't. What were they? They couldn't charge you with anything. Really? Maybe
no,
falsifying
I mean, they,
something?
They definitely take security very seriously up there because it's right. in kind of a rough section of the Bronx.
Right.
So the fact that a person was able to just...
They probably wanted you just to go away.
Yeah, they wanted to just kind of forget about it.
And that's hilarious.
That's kind of what happened.
Was
yeah.
that where you first started doing the acting?
No. I started in school.
In high school?
In grade school, I started doing like musicals and plays, mostly because I just saw that I was not a good athlete, and I wanted to be.
Yeah.
I tried to play every sport, and nothing really took. And I think my size had a lot to do with
that. Is that heartbreaking?
Yeah, devastating. Devastating. I mean, it was all my friends, you know, were able to compete in some athletic endeavor, and I wasn't. And so, but then I found this, and this was a great way to meet girls. That was it.
To do musicals?
Not as a grown up, but you know when you're in eighth and ninth grade, and so then because I went to an all boys school, we had sister schools, all girls schools, and they would do these plays, and they would need guys to do the plays, so I would just go and do those plays, and that was it.
So you had an in. You had to go to the girls' school every day to rehearse.
Yeah. Yeah, and I had so much fun, and it was just a great way. It was just something that I was kind of good at, and it was a great way to meet girls and a great way to have something to do.
Do you remember your first play?
Sound of Music.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I did the Sound of Music twice and played both. Like once, and I played the younger kid, and then years later I played the older kid.
And did you do drama and everything?
Mm-hmm.
All the way through high school?
Not all the way through. I sort of tapered off my senior year just because I wanted to get drunk and hang out with my friends. But then it never occurred to me that it could be a profession.
No?
No,
until
I mean,
when?
California was... Till that first year when I was...
At Fordham?
And when I was Well, before that, when I was just kind of coming back and forth, and then... I realized like, oh, wow, like people, I met a professional actor and I was like, oh yeah, that's an actual
who?
Profession. It was just a guy who was
right.
auditioning
in New
for
York?
Commercials and stuff. Yeah, and so he introduced me to an agent. I wound up, because I looked, so now one of my greatest sources of stress in my life was that I always looked so young and small. Now it was something great because I would get hired to play really young. So as actors, you know, you only get, I think, 6 hours with a kid under 18 or whatever it is. So they were always looking for kids who were 18 to play younger.
We just used one in my show.
There you go.
A girl, 18, she looked 15.
Yeah, so when I was 18, 19, I looked 12, 13. I'm serious. I would get roles as like a 13-year-old. And it was somewhat humiliating, but at the same time, I was like, fuck it, I'm working. I don't care.
So you got this agent from this guy who referred you, and they were like, oh my God, we got one. We got like a man-child.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was kind of it. And then I was living in the Bronx. I moved to New York, you know, with like a couple $100, but I was lucky because I had the meal plan and the room and board all taken care of. And I was working. I wound up getting a job working at a bar on the Upper West Side, but then I was just taking the subway down for auditions, and I started doing commercials.
Really? Like a lot of them?
I did a bunch.
And as
I
a
did
kid.
A bunch. Yeah. I mean, as a 19-year-old, I did a ton of commercials.
So you're making a living?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at one point, I made enough that I could quit the bar. I got my own apartment, and I thought, oh, this is great.
In New York.
I had my first acting job. My first like professional acting job outside of commercials was for a movie called The Devil's Own.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Harrison Ford and Brad Pitt.
Yeah. And oh, I remember that. It was like the Westies or something? Sort of.
Yeah. He plays like an Irish, an IRA hitman.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, I had only lived in New York City for 2 months and I'd already gotten this job. And I was, Julia Stiles was the actress. I played her boyfriend. And I had a scene with Brad Pitt and a scene with Harrison Ford and a scene with Julia Stiles, and I made some money, and I was like, oh, wow, this is never going to end. So a year goes by, the movie comes out, I get completely cut out of it, as if I'm not even, like, not even as an extra. Like and of course, I told my family and my friends,
sure,
and everybody's there. We're all sitting there watching the movie,
you
and fucking I'm not in it. Yeah. And I had quit my job. I mean, to me, it was all going to be roses.
Gravy.
From there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I started to look a little bit older. Now I look 19 or 20 or 21. And now I was competing against other 20, 21-year-olds.
Right.
And then I didn't work for, you know, 2 years. I had to go back to the restaurant or the bar and start, you know, bartending again.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You brought the family out.
Oh, everybody. I mean, everybody.
You got no word on that. You know, they don't give you the heads
up. That's happened to me twice, actually. And the second time, I got a letter from the director, which was really
What
nice.
Was the second one?
Wonder Boys. Which was Michael Douglas. Yeah, Michael Douglas. And Katie Holmes. And again, I played somebody's boyfriend. I played like the love interest of Katie
With
Holmes.
Lines.
It was like a minor. Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 It was a minor. Again, it was a minor role, like four or five scenes or something like that. But
and this was after The Devil's Own?
Yeah.
Oh, see.
And I'd already learned my lesson, so I was like, all right, well, we'll see what happens. But again, it was a high profile movie. Curtis Hanson was the director, who I loved from LA Confidential. And you know, like a month out. Hey,
was that after LA Confidential?
This was after LA Confidential. Oh, yeah. It was like right after.
Right.
And he was so cool to me. We were staying in Pittsburgh, and I had dinner with him, just me and him, and he was talking about LA Confidential. Then, like a month before the movie comes out, I get a letter.
You're lucky you talked to him.
I know.
Yeah.
And he said, "Hey, look, man, it's got nothing to do with you." And of course, it has something to do with me. But either way, you know, it didn't make it into the movie. And so I was just happy and glad that I got the heads up.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah.
So, all right, so now you're back after your big movie breaks. You're bartending. And bar backing.
Yep.
And what were you
living in Brooklyn?
Oh, in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I moved from the Bronx to Brooklyn.
Were you getting discouraged? How old were you?
20, 21. Oh,
okay. So what happens then?
21, 22. Then I was just like, I was depressed and I wasn't working at all. And right. And complaining.
But not discouraged.
No.
Just depressed.
Well, I was discouraged, but I wasn't ready to like pack it in. Sure. That never entered my mind. And then I was complaining. And so my manager was like sick of me complaining about all the things I was reading.
Who's your manager?
Nick Frankel, who's one of the producers of my show.
Now?
Yeah. He said, "Look, if you wanna read something that you like, why don't you write something?" So
and you're
did.
20.
I think I was 20 or 21 by this point, maybe 20 or 21. Okay. And so I wrote something. It was super dark. I mean, I never considered myself funny, and I was never going out for comedic roles.
First, that was the first script you wrote.
That was the first script I wrote. Yeah, and. I don't know. I thought it was pretty good, but you know, you need to get other opinions. And so I gave it to Nick, and he thought it was pretty good. And we wound up sending it out.
Not a comedy. Yeah.
No, like a dark.
People die in it.
Yeah. Like it was like kind of like a Scorsese ripoff. Uh-huh. And we wound up. I wound up optioning it to a company, and then. Then Paul Schrader, the
director.
Signed on to direct it.
Wow!
So
must have been dark.
It was super dark.
Yeah,
and that was the place of my that's where I was in my life at that point. I mean, just the life I was living. I was working until, you know, working at the bar till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, and
sleeping all day,
ugh, and you know,
the worst.
I mean, it was both the worst. It would oscillate between the worst and like the greatest, because I was still 20 years old living in New York City on my own.
There's something about that sunrise that kind of like sometimes it's like, oh, it's the worst, and other times it's like, yeah.
It depends. Like if I was on, you know, drugs, it would be the worst. But if I was coming out of that club, having worked an entire night, and I had a sock full of, I had to keep my money in my sock because I took the D train back to
what club Bronx. Were you working at?
I worked at a bunch. I worked at a bar called Bourbon Street on the Upper West Side.
Yeah,
a club called Venue.
Yeah,
and then a couple of restaurants up there. But you would get out. You would get out at 4:30. Sure. They would close at 4:00, and then you wouldn't get out after cleaning up till 4:30 or 5:00.
Right.
So I love that when I would have a sock full of money.
Yeah.
And I would see people up and like going to do their day. It felt like I accomplished something.
Right. You just won that war that they didn't understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So Schrader signs on.
So Schrader signs on. And and when I got that call that Paul Schrader was going to direct this movie that I wrote, and it was the first script that I had written, I was so excited, you know. I mean, this is going to be like such an amazing experience to learn from him and to figure out what my place is in the industry.
Yeah.
Because at that point, I was really confused. Like, well, maybe this is what I want to do.
Right.
And then I proceeded to have the worst experience for a little over a year
with him.
Yeah, but it wasn't necessarily because of him. Although he's a strange guy, but he's also a really interesting guy and a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
And I learned quite a bit from him, but. you know, he wasn't looking at it like, hey, let me take on this young apprentice, which I was kind of hoping for.
Right,
you know?
Right.
It was more like, look, do this and do that, do this, and then I'll just take it over.
Oh, fix the script. And
Yeah.
I got
and,
it.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I learned the difference between an option and a sale.
Yeah.
Which is, when they option it, means that they're just buying the rights to it, and they're not going to give you very much money. So really, I wound up optioning it for very little money. And the company was kind of shady, and it didn't, it was like they were supposed to pay me by a certain date. It didn't come. And then weeks would go by. And meanwhile, you know, I'm working at a fucking bar. Like, I want to quit and be a professional something, writer, actor. And so I wasn't able to do that for almost the entire run of that year. And then Paul wanted to go in a different direction that, you know, I was doing it because it was Paul, and I was like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
Tell me what to write, and I'll write it. And I would write it, and it wasn't good, and it wasn't good, and it wasn't good. But he seemed happy with it, and but it was taking it in a direction that I didn't like. And by the end of it, so the option's up, and Paul had just signed on to do Autofocus, which was that...
Great.
Yeah, that bizarre movie.
Did you like it?
I loved it.
It's a fucking great movie.
Yeah, I loved it. I love pretty much everything that Paul does.
Oh my God, that scene where they're just both sitting there on the couch jerking off, not looking at you, just talking. Yeah, I remember that one.
So that's kind of like, now you understand my experience for the better part of a year with him. It's like, he wants me to write things like that.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, which was challenging, but fun. I wound up at the end of the year with this movie that was... not mine anymore.
Yeah.
Not, you know, it didn't feel right to me, but I thought, oh, well, I did my job.
Right.
You know, Paul, you'll go make this movie, and that'll be a great, you know, great thing for me, and they'll buy the movie. And so I get this call, and they say, well, Paul just signed on to Autofocus, so it's going to be at least another 2 years. Yeah. And we don't know if we're going to buy this eventually, so maybe we'll just hold off.
So then
after a fucking year of this, with no money, and not a great creative experience.
And he just had you butcher your script.
Yeah. And I wound up with nothing except a great learning experience.
And no resentment towards Paul Schrader?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, because I didn't have that great of a person. I realized that I did it. At every point, I had the decision. I didn't have to do it.
Yeah.
I could have said no.
But you also wanted to learn in the way that's sort of like, well, maybe it'll make me see something a different way. And then after a certain point, you're like, nah, that's just not any good.
It's just not. And by the way, it's not doing it for him either.
Right.
Or the studio, who eventually passed on it. So at the end of it, he was like, well, I don't know, we'll see. And that was it.
So a year of that. Did you ever, have you met him since?
I have not seen him since, no.
So, okay, so that's a year of
I
that.
I doubt he would remember me at all.
Right. So, okay, so you do a year of that, and then what happens?
Yeah, and then I was like, well, fuck that. I don't want to do, I'll just go back to being an actor and just auditioning, because that just seemed like a miserable, miserable experience.
Well, when did you make the move?
Then I moved in 2002.
To L.A. That was I'm really going to do it. That's your decision? Like, I'm going to
No, that was me getting away from an ex-girlfriend.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I was like miserable and terrible. I was just in a really bad place, and I was just doing a ton of drugs and drinking
a lot.
In New York, yeah. And staying up all night, and I had a little bit of money, so I was...
Doing the blow, talking a lot?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Hanging out?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was so interesting.
What conversations.
Yeah. I was so interesting.
I bet.
Oh, man. I mean, you get a gram of cocaine in here, and I'm the most interesting man.
Oh, man, you got all the answers.
Yeah, I figured it out. We're going to make so many plans tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when that sun comes up, we'll be on that boat to Staten Island.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because that's the plan.
Staten Island.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go see the Statue of Liberty. You know, we're not going to let this... We're not going to let that Coke hammer hit us over the head tomorrow.
Right.
We got a day plan. We got it all figured out. We got it all figured out. And I remember having real problems when, like, the dealer, because in Manhattan it was so great and easy, you just call the dealer, would come to you.
Yeah.
So the dealer would come to the house, and one day he came to the house, and we realized, like, oh, he's late. What's going on? And we look at the time, and it's 9:30 in the morning.
Right.
And we fucking called in, like, an ecstasy dealer or something to come at 9:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized, like, this is not good.
And you've been up all night, and you're like, what the fuck, man?
What the fuck? Yeah, my third ecstasy pill is finally wearing off, and I need him to get here.
I don't understand.
And I know it's light out, but I'm hoping it's like, you know, 6. You know, I could still justify putting that last
You can't. Bit of... The worst.
And the best.
Yeah, I know.
That's the worst.
Well, you do get to that point of exhaution where you become so removed from anything that looks like a life.
Yeah.
And you're so insulated with the three people that you hang out with.
Yeah, and you know, you know enough and you've read enough and you see enough to recognize that it's all careening towards something inevitable.
But it doesn't end with like, I got it.
Yeah, I figured it out. I'm the guy that figured it out.
That's not the way that story ends.
No.
So you ran away.
Yeah, I got out of there.
Did you get out dramatically? Like just, I've got to go tomorrow.
Well, there was one, was one night where we were all hopped up on something and we decided, well, this is the night we're going to move. And me and my roommate packed, I had a minivan. Yeah. I had a fucking minivan. It was my first car I bought in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And we packed all of our shit into this minivan. In like a coke fueled haze.
Frenzy.
And we're ready to rock. We're ready to go. And he drove and we got through the tunnel and we're on our way, you know, like
to LA.
And to LA.
Yeah.
And he just pulled over and he's like, man, he's like, I got to go to sleep. I'm like, that's fine. When we wake up, we keep going west. We don't go east.
Right.
We keep going west. We don't go east, right? Yep. Okay, great. We wake up. He's sitting on the edge of his bed. I get up. I'm like, we're going east. He goes, yeah, we got to go east. Turn right the fuck back around and go back east. And it was so humiliating because we had friends in the building and we had like written them letters, you know, like goodbye letters and,
right,
you know, like fashioning ourselves like Hunter Tom, you know, like trying. Yeah. You
Phoenix.
Know, like, yeah,
Phoenix. Go.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're writing these like, these fucking, you know, Ginsberg-esque like poems, yeah. So, you know, like we're gonna go west, yeah. young men,
yeah.
And then we came back and they're like, they wake up, they see us there. Of course, we're sleeping, you know, because it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Right. What else will we be doing? Yeah. And they look at these letters and they're like, what is this? Like all of our belongings are in garbage bags in our apartment that we had
packed up,
ready to go. Just pathetic.
Oh, yeah. Man. Did you have to explain it to him?
Like, yeah.
Did you have an idea?
Yeah. And luckily, they were all, you know, they were at the same point in their lives. So they're right, like, we get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they got it.
So, okay. So how long after that did you finally go?
Then it was another year. I think that was like around 2001. I wound up coming out 2002.
And you had no real plan other than to audition? And,
mm-hmm.
But you had
Yeah, and I got a job waiting tables.
Were you going on auditions
mm-hmm,
too?
Mm-hmm. And I was working a little bit here and there, you know, bit parts, TV shows, things like that. But, you know, nothing really major. And then that's when I just had this idea that I wanted to write something else, but I didn't want to go through the same process that I went through before. I want to make it.
So what was the beat, you know, beat it out for me? You're like, I'm going to write this thing.
Yeah, I was living in this garage in West Hollywood. And
a garage?
I was living in a garage, yeah, much like this one.
Oh, behind someone's house?
Yeah, behind someone's house, yeah.
And it had a kitchen and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just had this idea for a short film about two incredibly self-centered almost like sociopaths, and I wrote this scene where one of them comes over to the other one's house for sugar for this coffee that he had made, and when he gets there, it's a guy he kind of knows but not doesn't really know that well, and the guy's like upset, and while he's there, he says, you know, I just found out I have cancer, and the other guy's all he's trying to do is just get the sugar and get out of the room. The last thing he wants to hear is that this guy's got cancer. And I thought, that's really fucking dark. And like, that's a really dramatic scene. But I wonder if I told it from the guy's point of view, who's just trying to get out of the room, could we make it really funny?
Yeah.
And so I just wrote it. And then I thought it was kind of funny. So I wrote it like a script for it that night. And I just worked all night until I wrote the script. And I thought it would be funny if there was a third character when this guy comes out of that scene with the sugar.
Yeah.
When he gets home to his roommate, he says, hey, by the way, did you know that Charlie has cancer? And the third roommate, the guy's roommate, realized that Charlie didn't tell him. And why wouldn't he confide in him when he confided in you?
Right.
And he becomes obsessed with the fact that you must be better friends with Charlie. And I thought, well, that's an interesting dynamic, something I hadn't seen before.
Like nothing about the cancer. Just that, like,
yeah, no, yeah.
Why would he tell
why
you?
Why would he tell you and not me? Like, that's that. I thought we were friends. I didn't even know you knew him that well. Right. Like, it'd be sort of becoming obsessed with that.
And yeah.
I don't know. I thought that level of neuroses I hadn't seen in a comedy before. It executed quite like that.
Yeah.
where the characters were just, you know, total assholes, like completely the antithesis of what a network note would be, which is to try to make them more likable.
Right.
I wanted to make something where you were as writers almost like actively trying to get people to root against them.
Yeah.
And so I brought it to Glenn and Charlie, and they thought it was, they were my friends, and they thought it was really funny. So
how'd you know them?
I met Charlie doing a really bad movie.
Yeah.
Like a horror movie in New York.
Yeah.
So I've known Charlie about.
Because he was like the real actor guy.
Well, both of them, actually, both of them. Glenn went to Juilliard.
Right.
So he's sort of the higher end
guy.
Yeah, and Charlie would did like a Williamstown
Festival. That's it. Yeah,
they were real actors, and I was just sort of like a scumbag waiter.
Yeah.
And
So how'd you meet Glenn then?
I met Glenn through our manager, Nick Frankel. Okay. When I was first moving out, I didn't know anybody.
Right.
Here. And I came out with a buddy, and it was just me and him. And so
who was that guy?
His name's Chris Backus.
Yeah.
Who's also an actor.
Yeah.
Although within, I think, 6 months of us moving out here together, we lived in this apartment in the Valley, and we had a fucking blast. He's like this really tall, handsome, like charismatic guy, fucking great guy. So one night we go to a party, like a Hollywood party. He meets Mira Sorvino at the party.
Yeah.
They hit it off. Within 2 weeks, he's moving out, moves in with Mira.
Yeah.
Within the year, they're married.
And they still married?
They're still married.
Oh, that's
four
nice.
Kids.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a good story.
It's a great story.
And does he work a lot?
But he was my roommate.
Yeah.
And my only friend.
That was 2 weeks.
Yeah, and he moved up to Malibu without me.
Yeah.
And so now I was all alone. And so Glenn came around and
and we
hit it off. So that when I brought the script to them, they got it, and we just started make it. I had sent the script to a couple of people just to see what they thought. Nobody really understood why it was funny.
Right.
But I knew Glenn and Charlie would. And so that's what we did. And then we got a couple of cameras together and learned Final Cut and figured it out from there.
And you shot a half hour piece?
Yeah. It was like a short film. We never thought of it as a TV show. It was just a short film. And it was mostly because I wanted to see it all the way through to the end.
Right.
One episode. I didn't want somebody to fuck it up. Yeah. One short film.
Right.
You know, I just wanted to be done with, have it be a DVD in my hand at the end, and like, and I fully realized.
And where was it set?
L.A. Because that's where we lived.
But was it set in a bar, or was it just?
No. It was just. It was actually actors. The characters were actors.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because it was.
Yeah.
It was the easiest. We were just looking for the easiest way to shoot it. So to have us be actors living in Los Angeles, it was just really easy to shoot.
So now you have this thing. This is the cancer piece.
Yeah, Charlie Has Cancer was the name of it.
And you did an episode with that too, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we shot that. We made that. And then we thought, this is pretty funny, but let's do another one. Because we think this could maybe be a TV series, and we know the first thing that people are going to ask is, well, okay, this is episode one, what's episode two? And more importantly, we see that you executed this, but we could prove not only to everybody else, but also to ourselves that we could execute this again. So we did a second episode.
And what was that one about?
That was about me falling in love with a beautiful transgender woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what was the problem?
Well, the problem was that I couldn't get over the fact that she was pre-op transgender. So she was this beautiful woman, but she still had a penis, and I considered myself straight, but I was falling in love with
That was in episode two.
Man. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was winds up being in episode two. Yeah, so anyway, we had both of them, and that's what we went out with. I showed it to Nick, our manager, and he said, "Well, this could be a TV show."
And then what happens?
Then we shopped it. We had an agent set up 2 days of pitching.
Yeah.
And we went to all the networks, and we didn't go to, you know, places like CBS or ABC where we knew it wouldn't quite
What's
work.
The point?
But we went to Fox.
Yeah.
We went to FX, Comedy Central, HBO, Showtime.
Yeah.
VH1 was doing original content then, MTV.
Yeah.
And we had offers from almost all of them.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
They loved it.
Yeah, everybody except for Fox. I think that Fox just sat there stone-faced, and I think they were just run by morons at the time. Not that this was so funny. It was just that they were looking for young. They were looking for this exact kind of show. Like, they told me this is the kind of show we're looking for, and then they just didn't get it at all.
It ends up on FX.
Yeah. So we had offers from a couple of different places, but FX was the place that, you know, because they most of the places said, well, we have conditions. We said we want to buy it, but we have some conditions.
Yeah.
And we were like, well, what are the conditions? And they're like, well, we want to bring in a director, and we want to bring in a showrunner, and we bring in the... And our feeling was, well, do you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then why do you want to change it? Well, it's not that we want to change it. We want to make sure that you can continue it. I'm like, but we just did two of them. So if you liked it and we did two of them, why would you not believe that we could do a third and a fourth? And, you know, the FX was the only one that said, you know, you do whatever you want.
Yeah,
because we had our own conditions, which is we're not going to do it unless, you know, I'm the showrunner and Charlie and Glenn are executive producers and we write the show and we act in the show. And then FX commissioned a pilot.
Right.
So we shot that pilot.
Right.
But I had learned my lesson, and I didn't quit my job at the restaurant. So I was waiting tables.
After you shot it
while I was shooting.
Well, when did you conceive of the bar and everything else?
So FX said, hey, we really love this. The only thing that we would suggest is Entourage was coming, had just come out.
Right.
And the show Joey, which was the spinoff of Friends, there was a Lisa Kudrow show that were all taking, Curb Your Enthusiasm, they were all taking place in LA. They were all revolving around the entertainment industry. And they just said, look, to us, the core of this, the tone of this has nothing to do with the entertainment industry. And I was like, that's right. It's about abhorrent people who have time on their hands. So actors could fall into that category.
Yeah.
And so could people who just run a particular business maybe at night, so they have their days free. So they said, okay, could you come up with another place to put them? And so I thought, well, I know Philadelphia, maybe I'll go with that.
And a bar.
And a bar, because it was a job that you didn't have to account for. They could all kind of own it.
It's so funny.
It's a great meeting place.
Right, and it's just funny because it is sort of like the characters float above the business.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you know, you're never worried about how the bar is doing.
Yeah, the business is irrelevant until it's not, until we figure, well, let's do an episode about it, because we need to, we've done 114 of these. Let's figure, we gotta figure something out.
Yeah, we got a story in the bar.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So you do the pilot like that. You don't quit your job. And then
I was nervous because I had just seen so many things had fallen apart. You know?
So when did you quit your job?
After we got picked up to the, for the first season.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Once we got picked up for the first season, I felt more comfortable there.
You write all of them? Did you hire a staff?
Yeah, so not in the first season, but in the second season, we hired a few writers, and now we've got a pretty good staff.
Yeah?
Yeah, we got a pretty good staff.
Well, it's sort of like one of those ones where I imagine it's got such a specific and loyal following that the people that you would find as writers got to love the show. And they're like, I want to write for these guys.
Yeah, that's helpful. Also, we went on a mission this year to find people, younger people, just that grew up watching the show, which is kind of sad. But
how many years has it been on?
10.
That's insane.
This is our 10th season, yeah.
How many have you made?
114.
So that was a real number. Yeah.
That's a real number, yeah. And that allows us to, I most shows, if they're in their 10th season, they've done 240, because they're doing 22 to 24 episodes a season. So we're only doing 10, so that makes it a lot easier for us.
But also, does that mean this was that you were just able to sell it into syndication at 100?
No, I think we sold it 3 years ago.
Oh yeah,
into syndication. Yeah, because they had already commissioned 2 more years.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually get picked up in blocks of 2 or 3 seasons.
Oh, so you were able to sell it under 100 because they knew you were going to do 100.
Yeah,
and they could start running them.
Yeah. So
wow,
now
that's great.
It runs on Comedy Central and FX and on Network Late Night.
That's great, man.
Yeah, it's the greatest job. It's my dream.
So what was the issue though? Like, what was the story with? Was the show in trouble after the first season?
Yeah. Well, nobody watched it. So that
that's trouble.
That would put in trouble.
Nobody.
Very few.
And what was going to happen?
One person watched it that we knew of, which was very important. That was Danny.
Danny DeVito.
Yeah.
So
after the first season, John Landgraf, you know, called me and said, look, we love the show.
At FX,
yeah. He runs it. We love the show. Nobody's watching it.
Right.
We don't have a ton of money for marketing.
Right.
But we feel like if we bring in somebody of stature,
yeah,
that we could generate a certain level of PR and maybe people will find it.
Yeah.
So we were like, well, we don't know who that is, and who's that going to be? And he said, well, I know that Danny DeVito watches the show. Would you be interested in? And you know, we thought long and hard about it, and we were like, we don't want to do that. It might fuck with the chemistry. He might be a maniac.
Right.
Were
you
a
fan?
It just might not work. Yeah, of course.
Taxi or whatever.
Of course. Yeah. 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 But we had our own thing, and we didn't know. You just never know.
Like if he was going to swallow it.
Yeah.
Right.
Or it would, you know, mess with the chemistry,
right.
Or that you know, one of the things that's really important to us is that we create a really fun working experience. I had done enough in the past where, you know, you go to these sets and people are yelling at each other and everybody's fucking pissed off. And I just thought, well, if I ever get to run a show, we'll never do that. We'll just, no yelling on the set.
Right.
Everybody's here to have fun. We'll work hard, but it's a comedy. So let's figure out the best environment to laugh. But if you, you know, you bring in some nut job and the next thing you know, it can crumble. So they could just become a cancer in the set. And then, you know, I know a lot of successful shows that people hate going to work every day because it's fucking miserable.
That's sad.
Sad.
Now I gotta I gotta pay attention to that in my own life.
Yeah.
Just like,
well, you remember that it stinks from the head down.
Right.
You know, so whatever mood you come in to work every day with, that's gonna permeate through the entire crew.
Right, right.
So I think about that a lot. I think about our, you know, our grips and our caterers and our, you know, people who've been with us for 10 years and they're like our family. And I know that if I come to work in a bad mood, it has an effect on their lives too. And so we try to keep that shit in check.
Good. That's a good policy.
Yeah. I mean, we don't always achieve it, but we try.
Yeah. So, all right. So DeVito, you think long and hard about it. And then what's that first meeting like?
We said to John, nothing against Danny. We love Danny, but I don't think we want to do it. And he said, all right, well, I don't think you have a show. So we were like, well, you know what? I think we want to do it. Yeah. You know, hey.
Sounds great.
Let's make it work.
Yeah.
So I go over to Danny's house, and he was certainly the most famous person, you know, that I had ever spent that much time.
Right.
Yeah, been to his house, and it was a surreal experience because he's the greatest guy. Like, he's exactly what you expect him to be.
Right.
The guy you see on screen is pretty much Danny.
Right.
And so we hung out for an hour, and I kind of pitched him a character that I just made up. We hadn't really discussed too much about it. And on the way home, he called and said, I want to do it. So then we knew we had a show.
Wow.
So then we made the second season, and nobody watched it.
With Danny.
With Danny. With Danny.
But was it fun working with
him?
Yeah. Because he's so fucking...
The best.
He's funny.
Yeah, he's the best. And now he's, you know, a part of the family. And you know, I mean, he's just been a great role model to have around. He's got great kids who were raised, you know, here in LA, and it's just, it's great to ask him questions and talk to them about how he did it, and, you know, certainly with such affluence and
fame.
In
terms of raising kids.
Yeah.
It's a real concern of yours. Like,
major,
it's hanging over you.
Major.
Because you don't want to have, like, shitty kids.
Yeah,
well,
pretty much.
How are you going to solve that?
Well, it seems to me like the common denominator. I mean, look, there are asshole fuck ups that cross through all socioeconomic and barriers. I think the one common denominator amongst really good people is that their parents paid attention to them and loved them unconditionally and gave them boundaries, and just gave a shit, showed up every day, and made sure that their lives were important to them.
Right, and didn't let them get too far away.
Yeah.
Yeah, drift off.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to certainly my wife is, and I'm going to make a concerted effort to do my best in that.
Right, and I guess the other trick is not spoiling them too much.
Well, yeah, that's
the tricky one, I think.
Yeah, well, that's where the discipline comes in.
Right, and drawing a line on the boundaries.
I think my parents, in some way, they would never look at it this way, but my dad had the luxury of saying, you can't have that because we can't afford it. That puts you on the same team.
Right.
Right? Like, we're in this together.
Right.
Whereas now it's
neither,
like,
one of us can have it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You don't get to do that, but we don't get to do that. Therefore, it brings us closer together.
Right, yeah.
And so now, my oldest son's Axel, it's like if he wants something and I say, no, what I'm saying to him is, you can't have it because I said so, and you'll learn later why it's important. Well, he isn't.
Hopefully.
But he doesn't understand that, and it doesn't bring us any closer together.
Right, right, right.
You know, so that's
yeah, because now you're just this withholding guy.
Yeah.
I could have.
Yeah,
that.
I'm holding the key to your, you know,
whatever you want, the
your
truck.
Gratification. Yeah, your instant gratification. I'm not giving it to you. And you'll maybe, when you're 25, look back and understand why it happened, but you can't right now, and it's not drawing us closer together.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, I always worked, but my dad, he was a doctor, he had money. Like, I didn't, it's weird. I didn't turn out great. So, Yeah, I mean, I'd be careful with that.
You don't think you turned out great?
No, honestly, and I've said this before, I don't think that I was ever taught, like, it seems like whatever happened in Catholic school for you was important. I mean, to be taught, you know, to have a healthy sense of competition and that, like, you know, winning and losing is not life-threatening. There's something about sports and about understanding, you know, your limitations in some ways around certain things when you're younger, which would be boundaries, and also about healthy competition. I think that just really helps you throughout your entire life.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you're not careful, you can go through life emotionally like a child, you know, with entitlement and not really having a sense of winning and losing or taking the hit in a dignified way. That's important shit. Learning how to lose with a certain amount of dignity.
Yeah.
That's
paramount.
I mean,
that was paramount to my high school experience, which, because I was constantly getting my ass whooped physically, you know, in sport, and also, like, you know, emotionally, like anybody is at 15 or 16 years old. And what they were teaching you how to do was to get your ass whipped and then just keep getting up and learning from it and moving on. But recognizing that, like, their job isn't to teach you how to win.
Right.
Their job is to teach you how to lose with dignity and grace and to continue on.
Right.
That's really important. That's, you know,
the whole thing.
That's the whole thing. Because your whole life is going to be a series of defeats
and struggles and, you know, and victories. But, like, but just the fact that, you know, if you're not emotionally fortified, that, you know, how you're going to buckle under the first series of losses could really define your life. You can make some big mistakes in those times.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think you see that a lot. I mean, I know with, like, young people that we hire now, they come out being told that.
Yeah.
You know, they're the greatest. And I understand that from a parent's perspective, you want to encourage your child and tell them that they're the greatest over and over and over again. But when you're 23 years old and you're out looking for a job and you've been told you're the greatest all the way up until this point, and someone says, hey, you know what? You're not the greatest.
Yeah.
And you watch people fucking crumble.
Yeah. Do you say that to them in audition?
No, auditions? Oh, God. That's the hardest.
It's horrifying. No, but I think you're right. And it's sort of interesting, too. Like, certainly in certain fields. Like, would you tell your kid to, like, I don't know what Danny's kids do, but I think he must have been a role model on a lot of levels, and, you know, just in sort of, you know, surviving in show business, period. You know, I mean, he is like this, there's nobody like him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I look to him all the time. I mean, he's got a career that spanned 35 years.
He was in fucking Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
And he survived it and he nurtured it and he handled it. He kept getting opportunities.
Yeah.
There's really nobody like him.
No. Yeah, no. I mean, he certainly transcends generations, which I think dramatically is easier to do than comedically, you know, because comedy is a hard thing to
stay,
you know,
relevant.
To stay relevant. And he's been able to do that. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he seeks out younger people. I mean, he says that to us all the time, like, what's funny? What do you think is funny? Because I'll do that.
Yeah.
Because his sense of humor, while it lines up with ours very often, you know, he still recognizes that he's a 70-year-old man.
But he's also, like, he's an archetype almost. Like, he's specifically Danny DeVito. So you're like, if you just fill him up with something, he's going to give you that thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whether he knows what the comedy is or not, he's naturally going to be hilarious.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And that, yes. I've learned that over and over again. When you see people like Charlie or Danny who are just naturally funny.
Yeah.
And you can't teach that and you can't learn how to do it. You can't.
Nope.
Yeah. It doesn't matter how hard you work.
Like, some people can be clever funny, but there are people that, like, just can't help but be, like, I just work with Andy Dick on my show. You can't stop it.
Yeah.
You know, it may be annoying after sometimes, but you're not going
to. Yeah. That's why it was so fascinating to me to hear Danny McBride. I heard the podcast for Danny McBride, because to me, Danny McBride is maybe the funniest.
He's another one.
Maybe the funniest person on earth.
It's crazy.
And the fact that he didn't really know that for so long is confusing. He never thought of himself as a performer.
Well, I don't
it's
know
so
that he, unless you get in front of people and, like, I know you.
But he's in front of people his entire life.
I know, but, like, there's that jump between, like, being the funny guy among people and then being the funny guy for a job.
Yeah,
it's just different.
But
he's so fucking
to be
funny.
So funny. He's so fucking funny.
Have you worked with him?
No.
Well, you ought to.
Oh, sure.
When you have money?
I ought to, yeah, sure. Dude. You know, when I would go home, sometimes I still go home to Philly, and my uncle would be, you know, like, hey, Robert, come here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know who you should work with?
Yeah.
Tom Cruise. That right, guy's good, man. That guy's really good. I'm like, okay. Oh, thank you. They think that there's some sort of like entertainment syndicate. That
my dad's
all,
like that too. Yeah. You should call Bill Maher. He seems to be doing all right. He says that to me. Maybe you should give Bill Maher a call. Like, they don't ever recognize your success.
Yeah.
Because this doesn't match up with the type of success in movie star land that they relate
to.
Well,
I get a lot of that. Oh, it's a movie star. Oh, here's a movie star. Now, meanwhile, I'm on television.
Right.
But that doesn't matter.
But they must think you're a rock star in Philly.
Yeah, it goes really well in Philly. Philly's been fantastic.
They must fucking love you. Because it's one of those overlooked cities in terms of just recognition, period.
Yeah.
So just by virtue of the title alone, they must be like, yay.
Yeah, Philly's a city with a chip on its shoulder, and one that they're proud of. And I think the show has a bit of a chip on its shoulder, and I think they respect
that. They love it. So you go back and you get free food everywhere?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I mean, this way I got the key to the city one year.
You did?
Yeah.
It's
pretty
awesome.
Great. Yeah, it's been pretty great.
So I guess what I was going to ask you, though, would you stifle, how old are your kids?
4 and 2.
Oh, so you don't have to make this decision in a while. But they're like, I want to be an actor.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say?
I would never allow them to be a professional actor until they're old enough to make, until they're 18. But I wouldn't discourage that. I would encourage them to get involved in plays and to learn, and to express themselves creatively, but not as a profession.
Right.
I don't think there's necessarily anything inherently wrong with that either. It wouldn't be for us.
I never thought it was, like, I never knew. But I didn't know a comedian was really a job.
Yeah.
When
was that moment?
Well, I knew that, you got paid at comedy clubs and stuff, but I never saw it as like this thing you had to focus on. And like, you know, when I was younger I never knew, I never really understood show business.
Were you funny?
Yeah, I mean, I was funny. I was quick. I was clever. But I think that with comedy, I really saw it as a way to say what I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, whether it was funny or not, I didn't give a shit. Like, mm-hmm. I just wanted the space to do it. And I had a tremendous respect for comedy. And I spent a lot of years doing stuff that was aggravated and angry and not funny. I don't know how many people like me as a comic now, but there was definitely a lot of years where I realized, like, I'm just trying to, own myself up here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to put you through some shit.
Because I got to go through it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to put it out.
And then drag you guys through it. I'm getting paid to, too.
When I was a kid, my father, we didn't have HBO, but my dad came home with, like, 3 VHSs full of George Carlin's HBO specials.
Yeah.
And that blew my mind.
Oh,
yeah. That was the first time I was probably like 12 years old or something like that. It was the first time I'd ever really seen a stand-up comic, I think.
Right, right.
And here was this guy, like,
oh, yeah.
Talk about authentic and
brilliant, oh, yeah.
You know.
And tight.
And tight.
Yeah. No fucking
tight.
Around, man.
And yeah, and what he was saying, I was like, what? Why am I laughing at this? Like, this is
mind-blowing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
As a Catholic, too. I mean, some of that stuff, like, if you listen to Class Clown, Jesus.
Yeah.
As a Catholic person, that must have been awesome.
Yeah.
So, but you're working with Bill Burr now?
Yeah, I just directed a pilot with Bill Burr as a star that we created.
Well, he's a great comic. Were you a fan of his before?
I was. Actually, these two brothers who work for me, Dave and John Chernin, they love Bill Burr, and they write for Sonny. And they were like, hey, there's this comedian you got to see. And I'd always heard about him, but I didn't really know him very well. And they took me out to a show of his, and, he's like one of the best in the business.
Yeah.
So funny. And then we met him afterwards. He's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
And we thought, well, this could be some interesting alchemy. So we knocked around a couple of different ideas for the better part of a year until we finally landed on something we really liked. And the guys went and executed a script, and it was really funny. Bill thought it was funny, and we made it.
How'd it come out?
Really good.
And it's for FX?
It's for FX. We just delivered on Friday. We'll see. You never know. But it's a great cast, and Bill's great.
What is this other thing you got going?
The movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm doing a movie.
Yeah, but that just happened, right?
It just happened, yeah. Yeah, I just sold it a few months ago.
But like
it's
that,
very
the,
different.
The way you sold it is similar to, like, you just take things in your own hands. How did that go? How did that go from idea to?
The movie is very different from Sonny.
Right.
It's not a comedy. It's a family action movie, sci-fi. And I wrote it, and I knew it would be a difficult sell.
How long ago did you write it?
About a year ago.
Why would it be a difficult sell?
It wouldn't be a difficult sell. It would be a difficult sell to have me direct it.
Right.
Just because there's a lot. It's just a big, big in scope, very expensive movie. And I'm known more for small in scope comedy.
Dark comedy.
Yeah, dark
what's
comedy.
What's the pitch? What's the one-liner?
I don't think I'm really allowed to talk about it since I...
Oh, really?
Since I sold it, yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
done?
Before I could talk about it a lot, but now I'm like signing NDAs and all sorts of shit.
Oh,
but,
okay.
But it's a big family... It's just like a big, scary family.
I should have called you a couple months ago.
I know. I know. Well, right. You know what? I've been avoiding you for years.
I know. I understand. Yeah. But it had to happen eventually. So how did you sell it?
I took a scene from it and I went out and shot it. And I called in a bunch of favors. I mean, one of the great things about employing people for, you know, the better part of a decade is that they're, and also treating them well and fairly, they're willing to pitch in when you have a project that won't pay them in the present, but you know, hopefully will become work down the road. And so a lot of people jumped in and helped me out. So over a weekend I shot a scene from the movie. I hired a kid actor and I had this company up in Northern California that did all the CG because they were big Sonny fans and they also liked the script.
Yeah.
And you know, now we're going to use them to do all the CG in the movie.
So you did a big...
It's a big monster movie. So
a big CG trailer.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How much did that cost?
Not very much.
Because of the friends?
Yeah, because of the friends and because of the amount of work that was put in, you know, from everybody across the board.
Right.
You know, it didn't really cost very much at all.
So that's exciting.
Yeah.
So now you're going to direct a big movie.
Yeah.
Is that where you see your career going?
Is
that what
so.
You'd like to do?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it, sort of what we were talking about earlier about how, you know, people just have this thing, like some people just have this thing. And I think we, even with dramatic actors, it's the same thing. Like, you know, Sean Penn is just a great actor. He was born that way.
Yeah.
He just has that presence. He has that charisma and that gift. And Tom Hanks, Charlie Day, Danny, Glenn, Caitlin, all the people on my show, they just have this thing. And I just don't think that I have that. And that's not even being self-deprecating or even...
Practical.
It's being practical.
It's knowing your limitations.
It's recognizing my limitations, absolutely, which I think is a big thing when, as you grow up, that you have to recognize that, you know, you can't do everything, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I need to stop comparing myself to people, you know, that do this big thing because I can't do that thing.
Well, that's that thing we were talking about earlier. That's like, that's a healthy thing.
Yeah.
That's learning to be able to accept that stuff and really kind of sit yourself down and go like... I can't. It's the way it is.
Yeah, and I find myself doing it, still doing it all the time, where you compare yourself to certain people. You know, it's like, I mean, Tom Brady. You know, you look at Tom Brady, and you're like, why the fuck? This guy's so fucking handsome.
Yeah,
and he's such a good football. Like, why can't I be that handsome? Or why can't I be a good football player? You're like, can I have one thing? And then I'm looking at the TV, and I'm like, well, can I have one fucking thing? You know, and my wife's like, what? Like, what more could you want? Like, isn't this what you...
Yeah.
This is what you wanted to do. Yeah, but he's playing football. And look at his chin.
Yeah, you're like a child.
Yeah, oh yeah, like a child.
Using someone else's success. It's not even in your wheelhouse at all, just to beat yourself up with.
Yeah, and it's so that doesn't mean that I can't have a really great career, but I'm never going to have the... You know, I'm never going to be...
But you're a specific type. I mean, you've defined this thing for yourself. You are who you are. People know, like, your sense of comedy is very specific.
Yeah.
As an actor and as, you know, and as a writer and, you know, and a director. Because, I mean, you do other stuff. I mean, I don't know. Why do you do Mindy Show?
Why?
It's just for fun? Or?
Yeah. Well, we became friends just through the, you know, like those showrunner circuits. And she said, "Hey, I have something for you." And I said, "Oh, I don't really know. I don't love to act, and or I don't like to do this kind of stuff and guest starring." And
yeah.
And she sent me the script, and it was so funny.
Yeah.
And I know some of those people over there, like Ike Barinholtz is so funny, and Mindy's so funny, and they have some directors that are really great.
So you're
just
doing
fun.
Yeah. Just
Chris Messina's great, and they had just they create a great fun environment. It's just fun.
And then what about with Lost?
Oh, Lost, that came about because Damon Lindelof and a couple of the other writers, Eddie and Adam, were really good. They were fans of Sonny, and then they became friends. And one day they called me and said, "Hey, we wrote this thing for you. Would you want to do it?" And that's a free first-class trip to Hawaii to be on the biggest show on television. So
why wouldn't you do that?
That's a no-brainer.
And so how long have you been married now?
5 years.
And you met her?
On the show.
Just...
I hired her.
You hired her and that?
Yeah,
how,
I hired her.
When did you know you were falling in love with her?
Season two.
Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't. We didn't really. She had a boyfriend at the time, and yeah. But I just thought of her as a friend and an employee.
Yeah.
And then they broke up, and then I don't know, something just started to click. I mean, to me, you know, I closed the circle. It's like the greatest woman I could ever. To me, she's the funniest woman working in show business. I mean, it's
nice that you respect her.
Oh yeah. I respect her. I love her. I mean, as a comedic actress, I think she's like brilliant. Like,
yeah.
Maybe the funniest person on TV. But as a mom, she's like the greatest mother I could ever imagine. Everybody should have a mother like Caitlin.
Oh, that's so fucking sweet.
Man. Yeah, man.
You're living it.
I'm living it.
It really feels to me like early on you were, you know, kind of given a fairly good framework to,
yeah,
kind of move through, and you didn't let yourself get too. You pulled yourself back from getting too fucking lost.
Yeah. Well, I had a lot of help, but yeah.
Yeah, a lot of help.
Well, I mean, my parents and my school and my friends and...
But I mean, it didn't seem like you ever got, you know, drifted too far into drugs to not be able to get yourself out.
No, I think my ambition was... would not allow that to happen, I think.
It becomes weird and hard. I mean, it seems like directing is the right way to go. And if you can get into that world, and, you know, if you pull off this big one,
mm-hmm,
it'd be great. Seems like you'd be a made guy with that thing. But acting's hard with movies. Making the jump from TV with established characters into films.
Yeah. Well, tricky. You also find that, like, you hit a certain point and you go, well, when does it start to just happen for me? And you realize that it never does. You just have to keep, I mean, very few people just get offers for things and sit around and read scripts and just get offers. And even when they do, that lasts for 3-4 years and then it's over.
Everybody's struggling.
Everybody's struggling. Everybody's got to be proactive. Everybody, you know, the people you see that are working for 20 years, they're out there hustling, you know?
But could, like, theoretically, you could probably retire right now if you weren't building a house in Brentwood, right?
Yeah.
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 So those guys, so you guys are comfortable, but you want to keep working.
Yeah. 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 I mean, comfortable is great. I like being comfortable, but it's like, it's just a very thin line to complacent. And that frightens me.
Right.
So when I'm comfortable, that's a positive thing, but I feel like it's so close to being complacent. And I feel like that level of stasis, is the end. Not
really?
Only creatively, but yeah. Yeah.
But theoretically, I mean, you could just, you know, take a decade off. And mm-hmm. just hang out with your kids.
Yeah, of course, of
right.
course. But
you have more you want to do.
Yeah, and I just want to do different things. So I did the TV show, and that was great.
Now you're going to do a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, I just keep doing something different.
Do you ever think you're going to get back to a movie like the one you wrote for Schrader?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like to just do different things. I mean, like, when you look at somebody like Paul Thomas Anderson and... How do you define that guy? You can't. Like, I
talked to him for 2 hours.
Yeah.
That was really
one of the most frustrating interviews I've ever heard, only
sure.
because you want to believe that there's some insight that he's going to drop on you that's going to make it all click in your head, or you're going to go, how does he do it? And he seems such like a dude.
Yeah.
And you're like, no. You need to be more, the guy that makes those movies needs to be more aloof, and he needs to have a certain thing. He doesn't. He's just like a guy making movies, and you realize, like, it's so inherent. Like, his instincts are just, you can't teach that. He's not, like, it's not a level.
He commits to his vision.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have an answer for it.
No. The Coen brothers the same way. You ever try to read anything about, like, their opinions of the movies they make? They're just like, no, we just shot it this way because we like it. And there's no meeting. It just kind of is what it is. And why did you... choose, you know, this particular angle because that's where we were with the camera and we just shot it that way. So I don't know if they're like purposely deflecting or if they really, their instincts are that specific and honed that they just do it. It just happens. It's
but
like
that's
a part
their,
of the flow.
Well, it's weird because that's their vision. I mean, when you got guys who work at that level and you've got people like me and you and film critics who are reading all this other stuff into it.
Yeah. Projecting our own bullshit.
Like, I am so hung up on the, like, there was this, like, I went to some class about, you know, semiotics class or something, or I don't remember what it was, but it was years ago, and it was in The Godfather, the first Godfather. So in the scene where Sollozzo is meeting with the Don, you know, Sollozzo is,
uh-huh.
right?
Yeah.
So they're shooting Sollozzo, and in the frame, you see a green potted plant. He's wearing new clothes. He's clean. He's fresh. He's young. And then he cut over here to Brando, and he's like wearing a kind of drab suit. He looks older. There's old pictures behind him. Like, who's responsible for loading up the frame like that? Mm-hmm. Did Coppola say, like, no, I need more pictures? Was it a set director? Was it a group think? Like, who the hell knows how that happens? But it is a commitment to the vision.
Yeah.
Like, they can't answer all those questions. Would you respect a guy that said, the reason we did that is we thought that if we saw up angle, that it would imply, you know, an entire history of bullshit that I'm about to lay on you?
Well, there's the professional in me that yearns for him to say that, so I can kind of get some insight as to how he does it. But then there's the person in me that's like, ah, fuck that guy.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, it's bull.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than hearing an actor talk about his or her process. It's like, it's so, it's just irritating. And I think it's irritating to the general public. And yet, you love and respect those performances. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yet you also want to feel like it's effortless.
Well, I think it is for some people. I think that's the weird thing about acting after talking to so many actors. It's like, you can't, you explain it just really the best way. It's like, some people are just born, they're just good at that.
Yeah, and you can hone it, you can get better at it. But it's not just about creating a believable moment, because lots of people can do that. It's how, are you compelling on a moment-to-moment basis?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Denzel Washington is compelling on a moment-to-moment basis. I don't know why.
Gene Hackman. Wow, Gene Hackman. I don't know why he always comes in.
Sterling Hayden. I mean, you know, like, you just take Sterling Hayden. You can go back for the last 150 years, and for whatever reason, it doesn't necessarily need to be the best-looking people. It doesn't need to be even the greatest actor. They're just compelling to.
Yeah.
It's compelling to watch.
Well, yeah, it's like, and also getting back to the director thing, it's like, did you ever see that documentary about the Kubrick fanatics, the people that read into the Shining, are like, it's amazing, these people that have all these, like, basically conspiracy theories in a way about their interpretations of the Shining.
Yeah,
and like, they're also kind of like well thought out and a little crazy, but like, you start to realize, like, could Kubrick have managed to have all that in his head? Yes, but the trick is, though, I think what we have to accept is that he might not have known it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything just comes together because they're honoring their vision.
Yeah,
you know, whatever their whole life has brought to them to that moment, mm-hmm. just like an actor, and that's what they're loading it up with.
Yeah,
doesn't mean they can't explain it.
Yeah, it's just it's intrinsically a part of them. It's just their instinct, and they're just doing it.
So you can be able to do that?
I don't fucking know. I'm going to try.
All right, man. It was good talking to you.
Great talking to you. Thank you for having me.
All right, that's it. That's our show. That was I thought that was a great conversation. He's a good guy. Sharp guy. Solid dude. And again, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's currently in its 10th season. It's on FXX Wednesday nights, and the season finale is on March 18th. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod related business. The Marination tour dates are there. Merch is there. There's going to be a lot more merch. I got after the tour, there's going to be a lot of posters in there. I think I got to work on some new t-shirt designs. I will do that. JustCoffee.coop is available at WTFpod.com, and you can check the calendar. I already said that. Get the app. The app. The free app upgrade. You can listen to all the episodes. Oh, man, I'm punchy. Boomer lives!